Welcome to Nothing New, a remake podcast. I am one of your hosts, Justin Keyson, and across the table from me is...
Hi, I'm Andrew Lindy.
Okay, so September, nothing really huge coming up in September.
Yeah, we wanted to dip into the vault.
Yes.
We wanted to pull out something different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we hardly go to the vault. I want to bring up something about our vault. That our vault, which we wrote right when we started the show 2 years ago, was we figured, well, on those clearly many chances that we are not going to have a remake every month.
Yeah.
We will dive into the vault.
Yeah.
That does not happen as much as that.
Not a lot. No, not really.
No.
So we are taking that chance this time because we have a special guest.
We do.
Yes. Introduce yourself, please.
So I'm JPG. I am the owner of the Geek Say What Network and a voice on a few of the shows on the Geek Say What Network, Ready, Set, Geek, and Nerds on a Roll.
And we'll get back to more details about JPG's shows a little bit later. But first, Andrew, we have remake news.
Yeah, well, let's say what we're talking about. I know it'll be in the episode title. People know. But this is one of my favorite parts where we can say today we're talking about The Thomas Crown Affair from 1968.
And The Thomas Crown Affair, 1999.
Yes. And this is specifically because JPG loves heist films.
Yeah, so this is like not... This is not what I'm known for in the geek community, which is like kind of weird because it's always been like a joke between us that like I really, really love heist films.
You were really mad when you weren't on our Ocean's 11 episode.
I was so mad about that one. Yeah. I was so mad. And then, oh my gosh, what was the one that Alex was on?
Fahrenheit 451.
Oh yeah. God. Which, by the way, I was an English teacher for a while. And then, like, I, like, lost it because you guys invited my wife to it.
Honestly, I think that was the best choice we made guest-wise. She, like, started off by saying, like, I love burning books. Like, it was...
I didn't mean Andrew, like, how do we take this? How do we take this?
I hate the written word. We were like, Yeah, so that was really interesting.
Yeah.
But yes, remake news. Justin, what do you teased me.
Yeah.
You said that you had something in that you weren't going to tell me until the show was recording.
Yeah. So well, first we'll do a quickie.
Yeah.
A quick one. They just announced a couple of cast members for the upcoming, I guess it's a remake, but it can also be considered a reboot, Mortal Kombat film.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, what?
Yes. They announced a new cast for the new Mortal Kombat movie.
I need to hear this.
Okay.
What? Who?
Okay, so far, they've cast in the role of Sub-Zero, Joe Tsam, and I think he was one of the guys from The Raid.
Yeah, he's one of the guys from The Raid, and then he also plays as a star for, oh my gosh, he's an assassin, and then he kills a whole village, but he saves one little girl.
The Night Comes Before Night Comes, which is amazing if you haven't seen it.
Yeah, you made me watch that.
It's awesome, right?
Yes.
So, they also finally announced, Ludi Lin from the Power Rangers movie as the new Liu Kang.
Oh, he's very handsome.
So yes, he is. So, and also, Tanabe Asando, who played, he's the one of the Warriors Three in Thor, the Angel.
Oh, yeah.
He's the new Raiden.
Wow.
I'm super stoked about.
Going with a hard Asian cast on this one.
Yeah. Already into it.
Huh.
And I believe Misha Brooks, who played Jimmy Olsen in Supergirl, is Jax.
Okay.
Oh.
So that's... the film is going to be produced by James Wan, not directed, but already it looks like... They've been trying to do some sort of new Mortal Kombat for a while, and this is the first time I went... All these actors were announced and went, oh, you guys are really doing it.
Yeah.
So Mortal Kombat is happening again, and all I can say is just bring back the theme song.
When it does come out, may I be invited back?
Well, that'll be tentative. I see, because you, just in the way that you said that, it might be a reboot. We do cover reboot things.
Sometimes.
There's the squiggliness of it, where it's like, sometimes it fits and sometimes it doesn't.
So here's the thing. So Mortal Kombat, the very first film from the 90s, like that and Street Fighter, I am obsessed with. And I will defend both of those movies like tooth and nail, right? Yeah. So if you do, I'm gonna put that in your head.
That's fine. All right, but if we decide to cover it, you're in there. You're clocked in.
So bad. But the street, if there's a Street Fighter reboot ever, I want that.
Now, here's what I teased Andrew with, and because it's a rumor that I didn't even know about till literally today when this announcement came up today, and a film writer I like named Drew McQueenie tweeted at a fellow other film writer and said, "Hey, remember when we had that crazy theory about that being a remake? I read the synopsis of the film, and dude, which I'm like, what are you guys talking about, Andrew?"
Mm-hmm.
The title for the new Bond movie that came out today.
Yes! No Time to Die!
Do you think you can take a stab at what I'm guessing at?
Yes! Okay, so I'm a fervent listener of the James Bonding podcast, and they had been, you know, going over the plot of this movie and the fact that it includes, what's his name? The CIA guy that
Felix.
Felix Leiter.
Yeah.
They were thinking that it would be closer to the one. There's a, I can't remember the name of these. They all jumble up, but it's the one where Felix Leiter like gets his leg bitten off by like a crocodile because they're like, oh, it has Felix Leiter and he's in it a lot. So like, what if they're borrowing a lot of elements from that?
Mm-hmm.
But then, No Time to Die.
Yeah.
Doctor, No Time to Die. Like, I can feel it, like, inside of me. Like, it's in my blood.
The movie even has a bit, like, the synopsis states that Bond's in Jamaica.
Yeah.
And if you don't know Dr. No, yes, that is predominantly in...
Oh, yeah, Jamaica. It's a lot of Jamaica.
There's a scientist who's coming up with some weird stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Felix is a main character in this, mm-hmm. So there's now this crazy rumor that No Time to Die might be a weird remake of Dr. No.
Well, because, and then, what's the guy who just played Freddie Mercury? What is his name?
Rami Malek
is the villain. And I'm like, oh, I can see him. Ooh. I can see him in the Nehru jacket. I can see him. I can see him saying, hello, I'm Dr. No. Like, that's just really... That's really good. Because I also feel like there was a rumor that Christoph Waltz is going to return, at least maybe just in a cameo.
As Blofeld.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like the way that when Dr. No came out, Dr. No was like number two inspector.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. So it's this idea that now that Blofeld is knocked out of his own organization, right? You have someone else come up number two. Like, it just really, there's a lot of pieces falling into place that I'm very excited for. Stay tuned is all I can say. Because even if it's not a direct remake, I feel like we can have a little fun.
Right. That might qualify.
When that time comes around.
Yeah.
We'll see how it goes. When I saw that the title of the new Bond film today, I was chills. I don't know why, because it's not, you know, the name doesn't come from a Bond book or short story.
Right.
And I think it also plays on our feelings about, there was a lot of rumors that when the original director was working on this new Bond film, Danny Boyle.
Yeah.
He wanted to kill Bond. That was the rumor, and that was why he got taken off the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that they call it No Time to Die. Because it's like, no, just, Danny Boyle, this is No Time to Die.
In a move of pure pettiness.
Like, there's so much at work that I've just really... No Time to Die is just such a great title. And everything that we've heard so far is also very exciting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lashana Lynch's involvement.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Phoebe Waller-Bridge.
Yeah, Phoebe Waller-Bridge is writing, doing some script drafting, and that alone's already a smart idea. Mm-hmm. So I mean, I Cary Fukunaga's directing it.
Yes,
so I mean, like this, it's it,
wow, that is diverse,
right?
They're working on it. They're like, how can we help? What can we do? But no one's seeing these. No, everyone's seeing these. Please. But yeah, I'm. Even if it's not a direct, you know, it's not going to be a direct remake of Dr. No. But it could use Dr. No in a very new and interesting way.
You know, I'm so glad, by the way, that was my choice of news remakes, because mm-hmm. that again fits into this episode very nicely.
Yes, it does.
So let's finally talk about The Thomas Crown Affair. 1968.
Yes. Directed by Norman Jewison.
Yes.
Whose last name sounds like a racial slur.
Yes, I almost feel a little funny saying his name. But he's a nice older director, man. He did like a lot of movies.
That makes me feel better.
He's like very acclaimed, you know, In the Heat of the Night. Jesus Christ Superstar.
Fiddler
like,
on the Roof.
Yeah.
Yeah, see?
Rollerball. He did a lot of movies.
Moonstruck.
Rollerball.
Yeah. The Hurricane with Denzel Washington. I actually really like that one.
I haven't never seen that.
Is Rollerball on your list, by the way?
It is. In fact, it's something we can talk about. We
the
had,
worst.
Which is hilariously Rollerball's director.
Rollerball also connects to this episode. Than one, everything connects in the universe that we make with remakes.
In the remake universe that you're building,
yeah, everything like, is hashtag. Like, it's all connected.
Yeah, you're like the MCU, but just remakes.
But just yes. remakes.
Honestly,
yes.
Yes.
Oh my god,
you'd be surprised how many people show up in remakes a bunch.
Specifically, even our lead in this film, not in this remake, but we have talked about our lead before in a previous episode. I think almost a year ago.
Wow. That's scary.
A lot of things are lining right now.
It is. This is very weird. That's very strange.
The Thomas Crown Affair, starring Steve McQueen.
Killing
it. You're right. I think it was a year ago we talked about him last.
That's really weird. That is really weird.
That is really weird because he was in Papillon, which they remade for some reason.
Oh no! Do you realize?
With Rami Malek.
Yeah, I was gonna say.
It's a web, and I can't see through it now. Like I'm reaching out, and it's all lines
just tangled,
connected together.
Oh my god, in a mess.
It's really it's almost like I'm stuck in the windmills of my mind. If you know what I mean. I like that song. I like that song.
The song's good. The song is good.
If only they do a cover of it. Let's put a pin in that. Steve McQueen stars as Thomas Crown. Who's just like a rich guy.
Who everybody keeps calling him Tommy, but if I was ever that rich, everybody would just call me Thomas.
Or Mr. Crown.
Mr. Crown,
yeah.
Right?
If we're friendly, you call me Thomas.
Yeah. 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 If we want to get nasty, you call me Thomas.
Yeah. We also have Faye Dunaway.
Yes, Faye Dunaway.
Oh, my Lord. She is.
Yep.
She is. In
Vicky Anderson. That was her character's name.
Mm-hmm.
An insurance investigator.
Mm-hmm.
So Steve McQueen, we've talked about him before. He, you know, he's well known for like Bullet. Like he's well known for, you know, action-y things.
Mm-hmm.
And normally, you know, in Bullet, he's a cop.
Yeah.
But here he's a thief.
Yes.
He's a thief and a rich guy.
Yeah.
And he does get to do some stunt stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I will admit, this movie is not what I originally thought I was going to get.
Really?
Yes. In terms of, the reality is I mostly know more about the 99 film.
Of course.
Than this film, obviously. Mm-hmm. I didn't even see the 99 film until we just did the episode, but like.
Oh.
It was one of those I haven't got around to once.
Huh.
But I remember like the trailer showed up like in every theater I went to in the 90s when I watched a movie in 1999, but I had a different thought on what I was expecting Thomas Crown was going to do,
mm-hmm.
and he doesn't do a lot of the things I thought he was going to do.
Yes.
Well, before I move into this, though, is Crown spelled with an E?
No.
No.
It isn't.
No.
Okay.
No.
That's, okay.
I definitely thought it was.
Yeah, me too. Anyway, so for me, I think, you know, one of the big things that stands out for this film is that, yes, Thomas Crown is involved in like the white collar crime that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Well, technically, this wouldn't be a white collar crime because somebody got hurt,
right?
During it,
yes.
Right? But he's so hands off. It's very weird to me.
So the movie opens with these crazy like kaleidoscopic like squares coming and going, like characters showing up, and
it's a weird song.
It's so and windmills of your mind. I think the. There's two key things to this version of the Thomas Crown Affair. And the first is that song. Windmills of Your Mind, I think, is so key to understanding what they're trying to do with this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second thing is in the title that affair literally means affair. Like this, it's this movie is less about the fact that he can rob a bank without picking up a gun, and more about the fact that him and Faye Dunaway make sex eyes at each other for like an hour, and then and then off screen do something about it. Like it is that's what this movie is about. Those two things,
right. No, I agree. And like, that's the way. Going back to that visual opening, that this movie is iconic for that.
Yeah.
That is something that a lot of film fans will point out. Is like that editing of split screen is, I wouldn't say unique. I'm not sure if this is the one that originated it, but this is the one where a lot of people popularized it or got a wind of it because it was so unique.
Yeah, because it goes from, you know, seeing a lot of images and shapes and colors, and then we go into, we have Thomas Crown is like on the phone with someone else and they're split screen.
Yeah.
Which had not been done a lot at the time.
Yeah.
And then it kind of, we get multiple squares, things zoom in and out, other people are on phones. It's a lot of phone work.
Yeah.
So then I remember reading about this, and they originally came up with the idea because they had to cut like 6.5 minutes from the film.
Yeah, I had read some rumors that there was, part of it was because they were trying to cut down the time.
Yeah.
But then another thing that I had heard was that there was a, some like nature film or something, some experimental artsy film that was shown using this technique, and that Steve McQueen saw it, went to Norman Jewison and said, "You're going to use this in our film."
Yeah, but like, I just think it's really cool. Cause like, it was art built out of necessity.
Yes.
Right.
Like yes.
It was, oh God, I really want all of this in here. How are we going to figure it out?
Yeah. And it's like, this is that is like kind of what's great about like film collaboration, right? If this is the case, let's say, yes, they need 6 minutes taken out, and in comes Steve McQueen here going like, do this visual thing, you should do this for our film. And I can't imagine how Norman Jewison took that at first, and then he sat there and went, that is a way to get the information I need to be told.
Yeah.
And it actually is super effective for that reason. And I love how you get all this like montage and you get the one in the middle shot that grows to a full screen to basically tell you now the movie's starting.
Yeah.
Where we are introduced to our first character in the film. I think it's a really elegant way of getting you into the world and then kind of setting you into the style of everything, which is very, very cool.
Which, by the way, like, how everything is shot in this, by the way, just like you were saying about the sex eyes, every time, like, I'm in a scene, like, and I'm viewing, like, it makes me kind of feel like a pervert. Like, in the sense where, like, I feel like I'm looking into something that I should not be seeing.
Okay.
Well, yeah, it does have a lot of, to use the artsy term, cinema verite. It's like, it's very like, oh, you're just kind of watching.
Yeah, could you explain that?
It's like film, you know, it's like verite is like reality, like truth.
The truth in cinema?
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
So it's like, cinema verite was like the early like reality shows before they were called reality shows. It was the documentaries, but that weren't about like specific topics that were just following people. That was a kind of thing that came up in the 60s and 70s. So that's you can see that influence in 1968's Thomas Crown Affair. Because the other rumor that I read was, so the film opens with, was it 4 men or 5 men? 4 men come together to rob a bank.
Right.
Yeah.
And another rumor is in that bank robbery, all the tellers and all the security guards knew that it was for a film. No one else did.
Oh.
That's the rumor. So the way you're describing it, yes, because the camera is just watching what's happening. People are walking in, and then, oh no, a bank robbery's happening. So it feels real, but it's scripted. It's all very, you know, of course.
That's a rumor. I didn't know about that.
Yeah, that's I've read that, and I feel like that can't be true. Because
hope it isn't.
Well, because the way the rumor is like, so it's like, so yeah, obviously none of the customers tried to stop it. Like, it's just like,
yeah,
that would change the scene, huh?
No, you've never been in bank robbery. It's pretty bad.
Well, I've not. If you have, I'm very sorry.
Yes.
Whoa.
Twice.
Oh my
what?
God.
Yeah.
Like armed or like?
No, what? Not armed.
Okay.
But I have been like, so my day job, right? My secret identity. I worked in financial institutions and up until this most current position and every other job I've had, I've been robbed.
Wow.
Whoa.
Yeah. So I've had a lot of jobs.
So let me get this straight. The answer, the opening of the film, do you feel like that's a realistic reaction?
Oh, yeah. When something like that is happening, you just sit there and then you wait until they leave and then you take stock of what happened. That's literally it, right? Like the whole like, oh, I'm a good guy, I'm going to jump. Like, no, you're not, dude. And honestly, I wouldn't even expect you to do that because this ain't your money. Yeah. like you can get money later. Like, this ain't your money.
So, Andrew, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe.
It's possible.
It's such a good, like, theory.
A bit of trivia.
And it's such a good, like, in a time period, it honestly could have gotten away with it. Because if it happened now, no way is that going to...
Oh, everybody's getting sued.
People are getting sued, and they're going to tweet about it, they're going to Facebook it, they're gonna TikTok it, I don't know, whatever, but they're gonna
that would make me feel old.
I know, that was intentionally what I did.
They're gonna make a Vine.
They're gonna make a Vine.
Am I current?
That's way gone.
What about Vine 2?
No. Oh no, wow.
You did a Vine 2.
For like a minute.
For like a minute.
Oh, that's sad.
They're gonna Reddit.
They're gonna Periscope it. Is that still real?
No, it's
Periscope.
You were so behind on so many things.
Oh god, I can't wait to write about this on my Friendster.
I'm gonna put it on my Zanga blog. Don't worry.
Oh. I'm Asian. You know I have a Zanga.
Wow.
We were all on there. Now.
So the way Thomas Crown sets this all up is first, I mean, we only see him meet with one person, but he uses a bright light so that they cannot see his face.
Right.
And he uses some kind of vocal changer. He speaks into like a microphone that garbles up his voice a little bit. Mm-hmm. And he has that man by the car. And so that guy's the getaway driver.
Yeah.
So he tells him, you know, where to go and where to drop the money off at, mm-hmm. essentially.
Yeah.
But so we can assume that he has similar meetings with some of the other people that are involved in this.
Right.
But then the way that we see is each of them is waiting wherever they're waiting by a public phone.
Yeah.
There's like a lot of drama where one character can't get to, you know, the telephone.
Right.
Because everyone's using the telephone.
But even when you don't know what's happening, you like empathize with the character immediately, right? Mm-hmm. Like you are just as stressed out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As him. It's genius to me.
Yeah. It's a good way to, it's a good way to like set up, like kind of give you the world a little bit by not making this guy a main character. It does bring you, the audience, kind of up to speed on what's kind of going to happen because you do have someone who's kind of normal in the story, but also because he's not going to be used as a lead, you also kind of use him as a sort of a plot device, because eventually stuff that's going to lead with him leads into the finale as well.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. It's an interesting take on using somebody normal, but it does allow you to kind of like, okay, I'm slowly getting integrated in the style and the tone of the world. Because it's going to get all stylized after that.
Yeah, and I think the other big thing with Thomas Crown is he's not cruel.
No.
He's not, when the driver says like, oh, you know, what does this entail? And he's like, there'll be no guns. If there's any shooting, you just leave.
Yeah.
And that's just how simply he puts it. He's like, that's easy enough. And he's like, but if you make it through, you get paid, what, $50,000 or something? Like, it was like lot for 68 money.
I actually looked at how much that would have been. It was almost $350,000.
Yeah.
Yeah. Is $50,000 total, or was it per year for him, or it was total?
I thought it was just total.
Yeah, it was in installments.
Installments, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. But yeah, so we see the team doesn't even know each other.
Right.
Right, but they know, they're all wearing kind of a quote-unquote uniform.
Mm-hmm.
The black sunglasses, the hat, the suit, right?
I just realized something. It just hit me right now.
Uh-huh.
They used this idea to do the opening of Dark Knight.
Well, sure.
It just occurred to me right now. Yeah,
but then everybody has a mask and...
But it's the same thing. Yeah, it's like no one knows each other. Everyone has a uniform and some guy hired him outside.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. Okay, I'm just saying. That's just like, oh, I'm an idiot. I didn't even realize until like literally right now. They took an element from Thomas Crown.
Because you said you never saw Thomas Crown.
That's true. I never.
But yeah, and like, it's a really interesting heist formula.
Yeah.
Because then Thomas Crown is... He's in a position where he can watch and then he can leave. He's not even anywhere near it.
That's what I meant earlier by, like, this is not what I expected when watching this movie. I was like, oh, yeah, and he's involved, right? It's like, he's not, and I actually was very thrown off, but then started kind of digging that. I'm like, oh, that's kind of cool. Like, that's Yeah, he's doing it afar because he can afford to. He can literally afford to not be there. So it's interesting.
And this movie is like an hour and 40-something minutes. The first the first 25 is this bank robbery.
Yeah.
The first 25 minutes of this movie is the bank robbery. Where we don't really meet... We get to understand kind of Thomas Crown through these actions. Mm-hmm. But as you would imagine in a normal film, the first 25 minutes, you're meeting the main guy, mm-hmm. you're getting to know him. No. This set piece is everything.
Yeah.
Because it also sets up... This is... The main problem, this is everything going forward for him. Mm-hmm. So I think that's very, like, I like that a lot.
No, agree.
Yeah.
Okay, so when do we meet up with Faye Dunaway?
So it takes a little bit, too, because we have the regular cops that are just working the beat. There's one who's kind of in charge of the investigation. What is his name?
Eddie something?
Hold on.
Detective Eddie Malone?
Yes!
Yeah.
Who plays him?
Paul Burke.
So the detective, and he's working on the case, and he's told, well, we have... The insurance company has someone.
Yeah.
You're not going to like her. And she shows up, and yeah, he doesn't like her.
Yeah.
Which, like, the concept of insurance investigators, whenever you have a heist film, mm-hmm. they're usually like your A villain or your B villain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? But they're always a villain, right? Mm-hmm. The insurance investigator is never, ever going to be cool to the protagonist, right? But then also, they're also going to be weirdly, like, just gray in morals and like, always, almost always battle ready and trained.
Yeah.
Right? Because, like, Faye Dunaway, she was ready to scrap if she needed to.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But then, like, I also think of, like, White Collar, for example. Mm. White Collar, there is an insurance investigator in that one as well. And when you first meet her, she steals back, like, a Bugatti or something. And, like, yeah. But she also has, like, a collapsible police baton. She hits the dude in the leg with it. Mm-hmm. It's just, like, insurance investigators, like, why didn't I know about this job when I was a kid?
Well, it's like, you know, like bail bondsmen. It's,
yes.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, that doesn't sound cool. Let's call them bounty hunters. We're like, wait, what? That's insurance investigators of this, like, high caliber are basically bounty hunters, but for items.
They're like soldiers of fortune, but for rich people.
Yeah.
They're like, your painting was stolen. I'll go get it. Your fancy car. I'll find it. But it's Faye Dunaway.
Yeah.
Someone who I'm very well acquainted with because of the film Dunstan Checks In. Don't at me.
Who was Faye
Dunaway in that film?
She's Mrs. Dubrow.
Or she's as, the one that
whenever
I
say
said,
Mrs. Dubrow, Emily says, do, 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 brow. Go on.
She was the one that I asked if she could get it.
Yeah. I know you have a type. It's fine.
My type is lady.
Yeah, fair.
By the way, you haven't listened to Justin Dunstan Checks Men.
Yeah.
We all say some things on there.
Yeah.
What was your guest spot on Dunstan Checks
Men? I did two episodes.
Okay.
So one was the minute... Actually, the Faye Dunaway minute.
You had a
funny
Faye
enough.
Dunaway.
I had a Faye Dunaway minute.
Huh.
Then I also did the one before. I think it was before the minute before you, I believe.
Oh, okay.
With the elevator shaft.
And oh, you did. Yeah, Speed. That was really good.
I did Speed, and you did Winter Soldier.
Oh my God!
Right? Yeah. It's funny we both picked action.
We had to. It was an elevator shaft. I had to.
Yeah. No.
But yeah, Faye Dunaway.
You're very acquainted with Faye Dunaway by now. Minute to minute.
Yes. She's not in the movie a lot. She's more in the latter part of the movie, but you know.
Yeah.
So Faye Dunaway here, this is kind of like, you know, early in her career.
Right.
There was a lot of rumors that I read that they wanted to cast other people in this role. Mm-hmm. Various big names of the time.
Right.
Faye Dunaway, this was the same year that she had done... I can't remember the bank robbers who famously died.
Tombstone?
No,
not Tombstone, but it'll be the movie about Bonnie and Clyde.
Bonnie and Clyde.
There it is.
It was the same year as Bonnie and Clyde. Oh. Bonnie and Clyde, a landmark film, mm-hmm. and really, it was that was the role where people went, "Oh, Faye Dunaway!" Like they really were like, "This, she is here. She's a good actress.
Yeah.
Oh my God." And so when they were filming this, that had not come out yet. So nobody, everybody on set, even Steve McQueen was like, oh, the rumor was that he had a not very nice nickname for her that was like, Done Fade Away.
Oh, God.
Because he didn't know. Nobody knew. And he was just like, oh, she's in this movie. Yeah, I guess.
Steve McQueen.
Come on. Well, he was men almost, are pigs.
He was. Yeah, we're basically trash. He was not even supposed to be in the film because it was supposed to be Connery.
Connery was offered the role.
Yeah.
Connery actually even brought up the fact that he kind of regretted actually saying no to the film after he saw the movie came out. Mm-hmm. I'll be honest. Like, McQueen is actually very good in the movie.
Yeah.
I like McQueen a lot in the film.
His face kind of weirds me out, but okay.
That's fair. But I think he's very, very good in the movie. But I can't help but imagine Connery in the role.
Okay, so also they mentioned that Thomas Crown is 36. He's already divorced and the kids went to the mom, right?
Yeah.
So this dude's paying alimony. He's 36. That means he's 3 years older than me in that film, and I look like I'm 12. He looks like he's 55 in this film.
Well, I mean,
in 68 was a very hard year.
He also
mileage.
Steve McQueen died of some kind of like lung or liver thing. Like, he drank and smoked a lot.
Oh, okay, so it was just the okay. Yeah. It was just more the lifestyle then.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was like, oh, he's 36. I'm like, he's 36? Like, I'm almost 33 at the time of this recording.
I'm 35 at the time of this recording. Yeah, and I'm looking, I'm like,
hey.
Hi.
We're all in our 30s now. We're all here now, everybody.
I'm not looking that rough. So. As I sit here drinking this beer.
But Faye Dunaway, I want to talk about Faye Dunaway.
Yes, so I think it's important to note this is so early in her career, people had not caught on yet.
Yeah.
But of course now we can look back and say like, of course!
It's funny because if you look at like Bonnie and Clyde and this in the same year, you imagine it was engineered to give her a big year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, oh yeah, everyone knew. Everyone knew, put her in these movies and she's going to blow up. And it's like, that's never how it works.
This was like Taylor Kitsch, Armie Hammer levels of trying to set someone up.
Yeah, yeah. That doesn't exist ever. And when it do, like the two you just mentioned,
yes,
it never works out.
Yeah, never works.
No.
Sam Worthington, it's another one.
I always say this is like, when they say, when the studio goes, this is a movie star, I always go back going, don't we make that choice?
We make that choice. My money makes that choice.
We chose Tom Cruise. And we still choose Tom Cruise. Because Jeremy Renner, I feel like he's another one where...
Jeremy Renner?
Yeah. Every studio was like, he's going to take over our franchise. And then every franchise said, no.
I'm really happy he's just doing Hawkeye. Though, so I'm just really happy.
That should be neat, yeah.
It's fine. That's fine. going back into Faye Dunaway's character, I think this is, it's one of those things where it's like, you kind of watch her and you kind of already know in this movie. It's like, oh yeah, she can go toe-to-toe with McQueen. Like, no questions asked. And that's the whole movie. It's them going toe-to-toe with each other.
A classic cat and mouse.
Yeah.
But there's also like a duality to it, right? Faye Dunaway is so... She's so high class.
Yeah.
She's very morally gray, right? As opposed to Steve McQueen's Thomas Crown in this one, like, he's very black and white. But the black and white is that I'm always right, everybody else is always wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then also, I think he lacks a certain amount of elegance, right?
Yeah.
Because he lives in this huge house, he wears all these beautiful suits, but a lot of the things that he does, he really acts as like a blunt instrument, right? Mm-hmm. Think of the polo match.
Mm-hmm.
Think of how he drives, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Even that dune buggy
is scary.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And even think about like how he even like lays down chess pieces. And like everything is just so aggressive and blue collar when it comes to it that I don't know, like, I even then, like, it was kind of hard to see McQueen in that, or Thomas Crown in that particular scenario.
Which I guess part of me would argue that is part of why the character does what he does.
Yeah.
Because he is, like, he's not that classy gentleman type. But he's in that world, and part of his reaction against that is... setting up giant crimes for him to commit while not actually committing them.
Yeah. It's the windmills of his mind. I'm telling you, the song is crucial.
If you bring that up one more time.
It won the Oscar. Like, it was... I don't know. I feel like it's so crucial because that is the exactly what you're getting at. The crux of Thomas Crown is that he is either so bored or so out of place that he just thinks of everything. He's just like, okay, I know how to rob that bank. I'm going to rob that bank. He can't stop himself. He's like, oh, I can drive this car faster. I'm going to drive it faster. I can swerve a little bit more. I don't care if I die. He's just doing it, just to do it, because something in his brain is pushing him to do these things. And I think that's so crucial to his character, because he doesn't need the money. They have that scene where he brokers a deal, he sells something to some other company.
Yeah.
And the other company is like, wow, we made a great deal. And he's like, you paid too much. That's all he throws that out while he runs out. And then his lawyer's like, Mr. Crown appreciates your deal. Thank you, bye. Like, just tries to cover that up real quick. Yeah. Just like,
I
not
feel bad for that dude.
Yeah. It's just, I think it's really fascinating.
Yeah. Okay, so when we go, let's talk about the first time those two meet.
Yeah, so let's talk about the way that even she gets on his scent.
Yeah.
How she starts to figure out this guy might be behind it. So they don't have much to go off of, but what they do know is that much money, to get it anywhere, yeah, it'll be noticed.
Yeah.
So they figure out that it's probably going to Switzerland, mm-hmm, for the secret routing numbers, that Switzerland has some secret routing number bank. I don't know. I look to JPG information.
Okay, so to give you background, Switzerland, because of World War II and because of like other things as well, like they're notorious as like a neutral zone for things, right? So their central banks actually followed suit, especially after the war, of like, okay, like, we're just gonna take your money. We don't have any moral qualms about literally holding money for you. Whatever you do with it is your business, right? So a lot of places will use that or Caymans or the Caribbean in order to hide money, because there's no monetary extradition. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's why Switzerland's so big, because it's the only place in Europe that does it, and they don't want to show, like, the Canary Islands, mm-hmm, or something like that.
Right. Yeah, I feel like it's in, like, so many of these movies, though. Yeah. They're like, okay, oh, yeah, we gotta send our money to Switzerland.
Well, it was, I mean, I would say that it's always been kind of like a controversial idea ever since they established it. So, and it's weird, right? It's like, oh, somebody's committing a crime. I'm like, oh, we don't care.
Yeah, it's a little odd.
Yeah.
So she figures out that they need to find someone who has taken it in their personal luggage, taken the cash,
yeah,
and makes a lot of trips over there. So they go down the list, and she keys in on Thomas Crown. Mm-hmm. Like, that's literally all it takes for her to be like,
yeah, she just picks one name.
That's my guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which, I mean, good instinct. Yeah. She's not wrong.
I mean, she's great at her job, obviously, you know?
Yeah. But then I think it also doesn't hurt that she sees the picture and she's like, oh, yeah, I'll go talk to him.
Already thirsty.
Yeah. But yeah, their first little interaction, she really does, like, say straight out, like, I know you took it.
Yeah. And I kind of love this scene in the fact that, like, it's two people figuring out how to make the next move. Again, yeah, it's like the chess piece scene later, but this time verbally. Like, it's before that, but it's, like, verbally. So it's them. I think it's... Steve McQueen's kind of smile in this scene is both really awkward, but really interesting to me, because it's him going, shit, how am I gonna...
It was also, like, a little bit predatory, too.
Yeah, right? a little bit.
Like meeting his match.
Yeah.
And then this scene also reminds me of the scene in Batman Returns.
Mm-hmm. Our second Batman talk. Can I say that?
Yeah.
Well, with
just that scene with Selina Kyle and with Bruce Wayne, mm-hmm, and they both realize while they're dancing with each other who is who.
Yeah.
You know, so, like, I love that. First off, that's one of the best filmed reveals in cinematic history, in mm-hmm my opinion. Mm-hmm. But also, it had those vibes, right? Mm-hmm. You know, rich billionaire,
yeah,
like, seductress who's morally gray.
I think it's fair to say that this movie influenced a lot.
Yeah.
And it makes sense. The setup is so clean. And the fact that it's like, it works off of so much just character interaction. Mm-hmm. Like, again, there's actually not a ton of really big pieces you think there would be.
Once that first heist goes off, the whole movie's about that heist.
Yeah.
About recovering the money,
mm-hmm,
proving that he took it, But then it turns into like a, it was a love affair.
I might make the argument that if someone decided to turn this into a play, you probably could turn Thomas Crown Affair into a play.
Oh, it would be easy to block it on stage.
Like, yeah.
I think it would be a lot of fun.
Oh, it would.
I really want that Dune Buggy scene, but with like other, like people like holding cardboard.
No, I imagine they do the Dune Buggy scene as like the Faye Dunaway character is like looking off stage. And then maybe he like rolls on, like he fell off or something.
I like it.
Yeah. All right, we'll workshop this. We'll call whoever we have to call.
We're putting this on stage.
Yeah.
We're not using windmills of your mind, though.
That's the song that plays when the people start sitting down.
It won the Oscar.
That's the song that plays in the intermission.
It's our finale song, too.
That's what you are in this scene. When the people come out and bow, windmills of my mind will be playing live.
Oh my God. That's pretty good. Oh my God, we went off on a tangent.
We derailed a little
there.
Bit. It's fine.
I can't even figure it out.
First dining scene.
Okay, so, but I also do want to talk about, I think that something that's present within this film that is not so much present in the remake, so I want to make sure that I talk about it, is that there's, I think, an equal amount of attraction between Faye Dunaway's character and the detective. She is equally trying to seduce him and it's not working. Because he is very much, I work for the law. Mm-hmm. And he hates the way that she flagrantly, you know, breaks it.
Yeah. That is the other fascinating thing about Vicky's character, is that she does dirty things on her side to get it done.
They literally kidnapped a child.
Yes, they do.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, obviously they don't hurt him and, like, they take him to, like, all these fun places and stuff. But, like,
they kidnap a child! Yeah!
They kidnap a child!
It sounded like you were, like, really defending it there and then you went, no, never mind.
No! Like, because they're these two shady dudes and then Faye Dunaway in the back of this car and the dude that's sitting in the car, well, like, this child
was stolen.
So that's,
Irwin is the character's name.
Yes.
Irwin Weaver, played by Jack Weston. He's the driver in the first heist and he ends up his wife tattles
wife
on
him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They put out an ad, which this is such like a 1960s silliness. They're like, let's just put out an ad. Hey, did you see anything? We'll pay you $10,000.
What if he would have lived in like the next county?
I know. I don't know how they figured out where to put that ad, but they got him. Because the wife was mad at him because he is spending. She even says, like, where are you getting all that money? And he has, you know, he has his little bit of his money that he was getting from the crime. So then they do kidnap his child to get him to kind of confess.
It's a lot, dude.
Yeah.
I appreciate morally gray characters, right? Mm-hmm. You can't appreciate heist films unless you appreciate those types of characters.
Right.
I feel like that solely crosses a line. Mm-hmm. And that's what really sets the tone for the third act.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because now, I think as an audience member now especially, I don't have any more sympathy for her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't, at this point I'm not invested. It's just, no, you're the bad guy. We have now figured out as an audience that you are the bad guy.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, and that's an interesting way of looking at it too, because especially in comparison to the 1999 film, because this ending sort of fits into that thought process you brought up.
I do want to talk about the chess scene.
Yes.
I feel like we need to make
we
sure
we do
to
need
talk
to talk
about
the chess scene. I agree. Yeah.
The way that they shoot that is a lot of, you know, action and reaction.
Yeah.
Not like no dialogue in that scene at all. It's just them. They're kind of both looking at each other. The way that they fidget, the way that they move each piece.
Yeah.
JPG, like you said, the way that he like slams down the pieces.
Yeah,
you know, like,
there was like a lip part.
There's a lip part too. There's a foot part.
Yeah.
They play a little foot scene. Yeah.
It's a lot. Like, here's the thing, all right? Like, I know that this is a fantasy film because nobody gets laid after chess. I'm sorry. Like, there's no way that somebody is having sex after chess.
If you look like Faye Dunaway and Steve McQueen.
Touche.
That was a classy flirt back in the day.
That was that was the equivalent of like, hey, you in? Text.
Yeah. WYD.
WYD. Yeah. WYD.
Would you like to see my queen's gambit? It's like, oh shit, here we go. Yeah. Knight to F3. Oh shit.
It's also a scene that I don't think most regular movies will have the patience to do nowadays.
Oh no.
You know, it's all told visually. It's all told with no real like narrative push outside of character push. And it's like, it's one of those things where I'm like, a daring movie will do it. A daring studio movie will do it, but not everyone will do it. And this movie does it, and it's part of the cat and mouse game. And it's a really cool, really well executed
sequence. I don't see how you could redo that scene.
Sure.
Right? Like, I can't think of a better way to do it.
Yeah.
And I don't know. But it was just like, I was reading about it as well. Like, it was what, 6 hours of filming? For that one kiss?
It was a lot, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel so bad about that. Just smushing faces with
closer,
face
Steve. Closer. Do it again.
The Norman.
Do it again.
And it's like the kind of kissing where it's like they're like, it looks like he's eating her face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So like once again, you're right. Like he's supposed to be like, if you're from the outside looking in, you're supposed to see him as like the peak of elegance, right? But then when he has these actions and we're watching this as an audience, he's a blunt instrument.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. I don't know.
I think it's the Steve McQueen-ness of it, too. I mean, he brings that with him.
I mean, like, I also think he can play smooth, and I also think he could play, like, I'm thinking of... No, that's Paul Newman that I'm thinking of.
Oh, yeah.
Never mind, take
that's
back.
That's fair. Paul Newman. They're all in that high class of actor.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
But yeah, that chess scene leads to that that morning after scene,
right?
Yeah,
yeah.
Where they're both kind of like having their coffee.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and she's you can tell like she's in too deep now.
Yeah,
which is I think that's very fascinating because she does want to catch him through, you know.
Well, I'm blanking out the famous scene of the dialogue scene is like, "Do you always get your man?" That's when was I forgot what that plays out against. That
before, I do not recall. I'm sorry, yeah,
but it's the scene though. Like that's kind of the defining Thomas Crown scene. It's like, "Do you always catch your man?" Yes. Do you hope to catch me? I hope so. It's almost that thing. I want to bring that up.
Yeah.
Because clearly, put a pin on it. Yeah. Now. But it's a big... It's one of those things where, to me, that is the mission statement of the movie. Mm-hmm. That those lines of dialogue is like... Mm-hmm. Like, you could have had a poster with those lines of dialogue.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the taglines for the poster. You know, it's like...
Them two standing uncomfortably close.
Oh, no. I'll show you the 75... I'll show you the 75 re-release poster right now.
Oh, there it is.
There it is, right? Yeah. Mushy.
Yeah, the mush face.
I would definitely say that now we kiss sexier.
Okay. We'll put a pin in that. Yeah, I think it's also the way that she gets in too deep and she does start to have feelings for him, even though she wants to do her job and turn him in, find the evidence. When they get to the point where they're in the sauna together,
mm-hmm.
and he's like, oh, well, call him up, say I'll make a deal.
Mm-hmm.
And she's like, are you serious? And he's like, yeah, call him up. She calls him up. He won't make a deal. The detective will not make a deal.
But Crown knows that.
Yeah, exactly. That's
you know,
that's part of their cat and mouse, and that is something that she didn't know that he knew. He's like, how do I can't tell her. I'll just have her do it.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter. Yeah.
It's a little gross and sadistic on his part, though.
Well, I think that's part of the cat and mouse of it.
Yeah.
Is that they're both kind of using each other. I mean, even the scene where... He gets told, oh, your rug installers are done or whatever. And he's like, what are you talking about? And she, like, used that as an excuse to get into the house to look. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're both kind of playing off of each other and using each other and not doing nice things to each other.
Oh, yeah.
And then they do nice things to each other. And with each other. And so on and so forth.
But I think in the sauna as well, like, that's kind of where it's decided that he just wants to pull the job again.
Well, yes, he says, you know, he'll do it again, and he wants her to come with him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's like, I'm going to, when I take the money, come with me. And no, she does not. Let's just jump right to it.
Yeah, yeah,
so,
yeah.
So they, well, and I want to talk about the bank heist, like both bank heists.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, as well.
Okay, so four guys, right? They all kind of recognize each other by how they're dressed, mm-hmm. but they haven't met each other, obviously. So there's a scene where they have to get to the bottom floor and they're like holding all the elevators and they're holding all those people hostage on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Right before that scene, the dude is like, oh, hey, I'm looking for this place. And then the bank security is like looking at it and then he just walks into that door.
Yeah.
The door isn't locked.
No. I think it was even open a crack.
Yes.
Yeah.
That really confused me because, like, even like back then, there was like bank security stuff. Right? He literally just waltzed in and put a gun to his back, mm-hmm. right? Like, it was so weird to me. But, like, and sorry, like, getting to see the inner workings of how, like, financial institutions work.
Mm-hmm.
Dude, like, there's so many fail-safes for this stuff to not happen.
Yeah.
Like, why are you transporting money through a public elevator?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was all this weird, like, stuff in the bank heist that really bothered me. And then somebody got shot.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
He got shot in the leg.
In the leg, yeah.
Yeah. Which is like... Which, that's the movie equivalent of like, oh, just rub some dirt in it.
Well, that's the movie equivalent of like, oh, there was no murder.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
There was bodily harm. Yeah. So, you know, it's like, they're dangerous.
Yeah, but then, like they check the slug and then, or like, and then they check the bullet casing and then it never comes up again. So like literally that scene was just for shock value.
Yeah, I think
for,
so.
For like a 1968 audience.
Yeah. Yeah.
I do also like, there's a really funny bit in the bank when they're investigating the bank after the heist is done. And the one guy's like looking at the floor and he's like, oh, this smoke bomb's not going to come out of this marble, huh? Like he's just very concerned about the marble being marked by the smoke bomb that they dropped on it.
But then they don't even care that they got like military grade weapons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Military grade smoke bombs.
Yeah.
What happened?
Mm-hmm. 'Cause then when they do it again, it's essentially the same thing.
It's the and how they show it, you know, we take 25 minutes in that very beginning.
Yeah.
The second scene's like 2 seconds.
Yeah.
Well, because we know now.
Yeah.
That is kind of cool in that regard. It's like, listen, it's the same thing.
They literally did the same heist and it worked again.
It was different guys though, right?
It was different. Yeah,
it was different guys. So, yeah, it's almost like, we're not going to show you the whole thing again, but I think there's also something about the idea that, like, this is how, you know, like, but you know, the planning is like, it's the same fucking plan.
Well, okay, it wasn't exactly the same because the guy
more
dropped the groceries, but it was the same idea of like, you just get in there and get the elevator money.
Yeah.
Like, elevator money.
If you just drop some groceries, everybody will be distracted long enough. But yeah, that.
Then we head off to the drop, right?
Yeah, so the drop is at a cemetery. We saw that in the opening
like
scene.
The beginning
and
it was
at the end. Yeah. Except this time, Faye Dunaway and the cops are watching for the drop because they know that he will come and pick up the drop.
Mm-hmm.
But the car that comes doesn't have Steve McQueen in it.
Yeah.
It has like a telegram boy.
Yeah. Good old fashioned telegram boy. And he gives a note to Vicky.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, Thomas has already left.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's in a plane.
Because even throughout the entire film, we still forget he doesn't need the money.
Yeah.
He still had the first bank heist and the kajillions of dollars that he has.
Right. She rips up the note and like just like throws it in the car.
Well, yeah, because the note says, you know, come with me or keep the car.
She still made out like a bandit on that one, right? Like, she gets a car. Anyway.
But she does, it is kind of showing up as a bit of a conflict for her, right? And it's not really fully resolved.
Yeah.
It's like she is sitting there going like,
of money that he stole from the bank the first time, today dollars would be almost $14 million.
Yeah. It's a lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot of bags.
Uh-huh.
Ooh, okay, sorry. Yeah, sorry. Got to just wrap my head around that. This is your classic kind of mildly, like, sad, mildly ambiguous kind of an ending.
But I love this ending.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's, you know, we're as an audience, we're so used to the happy ending for both people who we want to be happy.
Right.
But and then this kind of reminds us that we kind of don't want one of them to be happy.
Right.
Either one of them gets caught or the other one doesn't get their person.
Yeah.
Well, and that's what you brought up earlier, right? With, like, when the moment Faye Dunaway organizes a plan to basically kidnap a child, even if the child doesn't have any harm, she organizes a plan to kidnap a child. She... The sympathy for her is thrown out the window at that point to a certain degree, so you don't feel that bad. But you feel conflicted for her.
I feel conflicted, but also like she kind of deserved it, and I didn't think the film was going to be brave enough to do that.
Right. But it was. It definitely was. Okay.
Yeah. I guess that's it for Thomas Crown Affair 1968. When we'll be right back, we'll be talking about Thomas Crown Affair 1999.
Peckish this midnight? Sate your appetite for terror and reserve your ears for a feast of the sound. The Midnight Marinara podcast is here for you, intrepid listener. We sample only the finest and sinister stories and, coating them with our own unique spooky sauce, present them to you as eerie audio dramas. Tune in as Midnight Marinara sends shivers of fear and spasms of laughter through you. Bon appetit.
And we're back. Now, before we jump into, what, 31 years since the original film, I do want to bring up a little plug about our Patreon. Don't forget to check out our Patreon. And hilariously enough, our Patreon's episode is actually about knockoffs, and that seems appropriate concerning what we're going to be talking about next. So here's a little bit from our Patreon.
When I grew up in an action movie household.
Okay.
We had my dad just bought every VHS tape that was some kind of action movie.
Okay.
So I saw Escape from LA a bunch.
Sure.
At some point in my childhood, maybe even into my teens, I realized, wait, there's another movie called Escape from New York that Escape from LA is a sequel to. And if you enjoyed that, you can go to patreon.com/nothingnew. Become a Patreon. Make us happy.
It's $1 a month.
And you get a lot of bonus episodes. One per month, and we've been doing it for a while now. So check that out. Thanks. All right. JPG.
Yes.
Tell us about yourself, what you do, where you are on the internet, where you are in real life, where you are right now.
I was born on a Friday night. Sorry. All right, so I'm JPG. I am the owner of the Geek Say What Network. It is a network that focuses on introduction and inclusivity in geek culture, making sure that we have a space, that everybody who wants to be a part of geek culture has a space. There's a lot of gatekeeping. There are a lot of barriers being put into place by people already in the culture. We always want to make sure that we are creating shows and a space that that open you up to that. So that being said, oh my gosh, how many shows do I have now? okay, so 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So I have 6 shows total. So 5 podcasts and a Twitch live stream. We're going to have another Twitch live stream pretty soon. And we're working on some other projects as well because I'm an idiot.
I understand that feeling.
And so I'm on 2 of the shows, actually. I'm featured on 2 of the shows. The first one, it's one of our newest shows called Nerds on a Roll. We actually acquired them. And it's an actual play podcast that that builds meaningful stories and brings them to the tabletop. As of right now, I am playing the Wokest Barbarian.
Wow.
And then I'm also going to be playing some superheroes and some supervillains in our next season also. And then the show that I'm on every week is called Ready, Set, Geek. That is your starting line to geek culture. So our fans will write in what they want us to review in order to get into it, and then we break it down to whatever they need us to be. So if they wanted to get into Batman, for example, we tell them where to start with comic books. We tell them where to start in the films or the TV shows. Gosh, what else? We just did... Well, oh yeah, like last month.
Justin and I have both been on.
Oh yeah, yeah. So Keyzone was just on the Sentai one that we recorded last month.
That's right.
And then Andrew was on Detective Pikachu.
Yeah.
Where we found out that Cole says words wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we exploited that.
Yes. This podcast comes out like a month after my other one came out. But during the DuckTales episode, we found out another word that Cole can't say correctly.
No.
Yeah. Can't so, hey, to... just, you know, go back and listen to our DuckTales
episode. Is it like quack? Like,
no.
Just...
no. No.
Gosling. No, that's Darkwing Duck. That's
it
Darkwing Duck.
I can't...
Webby. Magica.
Are you watching DuckTales,
by the way? I am watching DuckTales.
It is incredible.
It's pretty good.
So good. Yes.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah. So make sure to check out the Geeks and What Network. You can find all of our podcasts and all of our shows under the handle at GeekSayWhat.
Very good. All right. Are we ready to talk about Thomas Crown Affair 1999.
Can we stop by the museum first? I want to check out my favorite painting.
So petty. So petty.
I like that haystack.
I love it. I'm going to bring up, I'm going to bust out my smushed croissant that I brought.
Okay, so Thomas Crown Affair 1968, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're, you know, like, yeah, obviously those two people wanted to bang. In the Thomas Crown Affair 1999. The entire movie is about them banging. And then even after they bang, they're still trying to bang.
Uh-huh.
It's impressive.
It is. That is what makes it the 90s.
It reminded me of, like, one of the first times I saw a dirty movie when I wasn't supposed to be watching it. You know, it's like that feeling came over. Like, oh my God, I'm not supposed to be doing this. You know, like,
yeah. I do think this film is rather famous for the sex scene.
Yeah.
Like, there. Okay.
The extended explicit sex scene.
Yeah, there was a lot that was happening.
Mm-hmm.
But then also, I think, you know, getting to watch it, because I watched it when it first came out, which, by the way, I think I was 12 when this came out. And my dad was like, oh, let's just go see it. I'm like, I guess, okay. But so I saw it in theaters. And then I saw it, like, you know, a week or two ago, just to, like, refresh myself.
Yeah.
That scene is tame now in comparison, but it's still pretty jarring.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, all of her dresses. Like, nobody would get away with that.
No.
No.
Let's talk about... It's directed by John McTiernan.
Yes.
You know, Die Hard.
Die Hard.
You know,
Predator.
Yeah.
Last Action Hero?
Yeah.
Is him, but I'm, you know...
You put some respect to that name. Right? Said Last Action Hero like it's not a treasure.
McTiernan is, when he's good, he's good.
Well, and then, I mean, let's not forget...
Mm-hmm.
Has he not made a film since he came out of jail?
Yes.
Yeah.
He has not made a film since he was in jail. But
I would like context for this.
He was in jail.
He was wiretapping.
Yeah.
He was wiretapping someone. I don't remember the full story. But it's not murder or sex crime. It was wiretapping.
Okay. Yeah. That makes me feel better.
But he went for two, I think it was 2 years, huh?
2 years, yeah.
Yeah. But it was enough for it to pretty much destroy his career and any... I think he doesn't have the funds to do it. That's honestly what's happened now. He has a lot of ideas. I was going to save this for later, but while he was in jail, he did come up with a sequel for this film.
Huh.
I want to see that now.
And it was going to be called Thomas Crown and the Red Lioness.
Mm-hmm.
And it was supposedly kind of a remake of another heist film called Top Copy, except it would just use the Thomas Crown character in that heist.
Interesting.
Yeah, I've never actually seen that film, but I've heard about it, so I know that it's one of the acclaimed heist films of the 60s, you know? Huh. So I kind of like that idea of when you have just, like, you can take heist films of the 60s and connect them now through remake sequel culture. Like, that's visionary. McTiernan if he made it, I'd see it.
Yeah. He's the thing, like I said, when he's good, he's good.
Mm-hmm.
When he's bad, he's pretty bad. Hmm. And when he's mediocre, I don't remember that movie. But, like, when he's on fire, he's on fire. And, like, Die Hard is still freaking Die Hard. I mean, that movie holds up like crazy.
How do you rank this film then?
In this one?
Yeah.
In that structure I just gave it?
Yes.
It is below... Here's the thing. It's definitely below, like, a Die Hard or a Predator. But it's definitely better than, say, oh, God, Basic with John Travolta.
Oh.
And oddly enough, he remade another Norman Jewison film called Rollerball.
He's the director of the other Rollerball?
Yeah.
So it's kind of weird
Chris, what's Klein. His name? Chris Klein. And then it happens in Russia because you can't do anything. Everything that illegal has to happen in Russia.
Yeah.
It's really weird that he decided to try, one, Norman Jewison again. Two, Rollerball sucked.
But then, like, wasn't, like, LL Cool J in it or something like that?
Uh-huh, LL Cool J. I think...
God.
Rebecca Romijn. Thank you.
Yeah.
It's a very early 2000s film where we're like, get the guy for American Pie, get LL Cool J, and get the blue lady from X-Men.
Wow. Harsh. Anyway, so we talked a little bit last time about, like, the... kind of like the blunt force of Steve McQueen, right?
Right.
With Pierce Brosnan, this was the exact opposite, and this is exactly what I wanted, right?
Mm-hmm.
I wanted there to be a gentleman thief feel, right?
Right.
I wanted there to be elegance. I wanted there to be like a... I wanted there to be flair and substance to it. Like, this gave me what I wanted.
Well, and then I think what's actually really interesting is that if you are very familiar with the original film, which we all were watching this one, the way that they start the 99 Thomas Crown is with there is a group of thieves breaking into the Met.
Yeah.
And it's not, it seems disconnected from Thomas Crown.
Right.
Yeah, it seems like he's not in charge of it.
Yeah, it's like boardroom meetings.
Like he's like, he's doing his business stuff, but we don't know that he has anything to do with the four guys or three guys that break into.
Now, before that, though, I do want to bring up the big surprise.
Away. With the surprise.
Well, this is the cool thing. For me, at least. What I did was I kind of watched them back to back.
Mm-hmm.
So I just finished 1968, Thomas Crown Affair. It's like, all right, start the other one. Credits roll, blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden, and I'm kind of like doing, I'm actually like taking care of something in the kitchen. I'm kind of like prepping. All of a sudden I hear a way too familiar voice. Then I'm like, wait a minute. Wait. What? And I turn around, did you use audio from the first movie of Faye Dunaway? I flat out forgot. Faye Dunaway is in the remake.
She's Thomas Crown's psychiatrist.
Yes.
Which is, I think...
That's a genius way of bringing her in.
So genius. And I think also genius in the sense that in the original, Thomas Crown is isolated. He has no one that he works with as like a dependable person.
Mm-hmm.
The closest they get is he has the butler or valet or whatever he's supposed to be.
Yeah.
Who is also a character in the 99 version played by James... Is it James... Who is it?
I'm trying to...
Is it James Sato?
I think so.
Am I pulling that?
I'm going to look at that real quick. Because I recognize him.
No. Wait. Where is he? Well, I can't find names, apparently.
Give it a minute. Yeah.
I give up.
Yeah.
But I think that's so fascinating because you have someone that Thomas Crown can talk to.
Right.
Someone that is... They just have little scenes together.
James Sato, by the way.
Yes.
I'll put a small pin on him in a minute. But yes, okay. James Sato, yeah.
But so Faye Dunaway gets to... Instead of chasing after Thomas Crown, she's almost like in on it with him.
Like mentoring him.
Yeah.
Kind of, yeah.
The movie opens with her having this literal talk with Thomas Crown and you're hearing her say that name. And again, like I said, I forgot she's in it. Mm-hmm. So again, I'm just hearing him going, why am I hearing Faye Dunaway talking about Thomas Crown?
I just finished this.
I turn around and I'm like, it is a, like you said, JBG, it's like, she is almost in on it now because she's someone that Thomas Crown could confine to.
Well, and she starts with, tell me about the women. That's a strong opening where it's like, we know you're a ladies' man. Tell me about the women. But
it establishes a tone in one sentence.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good use of her, and it's very clear that it's a use clearly made to get her in the movie.
Yeah.
And I love it. Yeah. It's like, we gotta get Faye Dunaway somehow in this thing. And it's like, they didn't want to give her a cameo. It's like, no. use Faye Dunaway. Give her something to do.
Mm-hmm. It's really smart because I think something like that could be extremely distracting, but I think this really serves the movie.
Yeah.
It really serves the character of Thomas Crown, and it really serves the structure of the film.
Yeah.
Having someone who's almost like on his side, but is able to call him out on his bullshit.
But I think that also is a genius move as well, because she kind of acts as the voice of the audience.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Because you want to say all the things that she's saying to him.
Have we mentioned the cast? It's kind of funny. Well, I don't think we've talked about it.
Pierce Brosnan.
Yeah.
That's the Bond connection.
Yeah. Because
Sean Connery was originally going to play him in the original. And now we got another Bond to play him in the thing.
Mm-hmm.
There is a fun rumor about the fact that Pierce Brosnan, you know, is playing Thomas Crown. There's a scene where Thomas Crown is at a black tie event.
Mm-hmm.
But his tie is undone.
Yes.
He calls out Rene Russo's investigator character for not being in, you know,
black and white.
And she doesn't say anything about his tie. The rumor is the tie was undone because within his contract for James Bond films, he was not allowed to appear in a tuxedo in anything but James Bond films. So by having the undone tie, he was not in a full tuxedo.
That is amazing.
That's the rumor. I don't know if it's true, but I love it.
That sounds real to me.
Yeah.
That
sounds so great.
Yeah. Also, it's weird because it's also kind of character. It's okay.
Yeah.
That also signifies he's not James Bond.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's a lot of it that is, but he's not. Let's not lie.
Yeah.
He's not James Bond. This time, the character's name is Catherine Banning, who is the insurance investigator, but she is played now by Rene Russo.
Mm-hmm.
She is stunning.
Yeah. Still is, obviously.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Yeah. No, is the specific verb that I used for that.
That's true. And I think this was interesting. We talked about the sex scene and, like, this was a kind of a big deal. That was part of the talks of the movie back in 99, is she was, if not mistaken, actually pushing 40, if not 40.
She was 45.
She was 45.
Goodness.
I know.
And, hey, you know what? Let's plot some things. One, Pierce's character is actually around 40. She's 45.
Age appropriate.
That doesn't happen.
I feel like we need like an alarm. When age appropriate. We did it.
And yes, it's a really good use of Rene Russo.
Well, and from what I read, that this was the first film where she went topless.
Yeah.
Goodness.
And what a choice. What a great choice.
She, oh my gosh.
She, not because, I mean, she, not because
no,
she
was no body
topless. Not because she was topless. That's not the reason why it was a good choice.
Because the way that they use it for her flirting.
Yeah.
When they get to that later scene where they're in like Martinique or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And the towel scene where she flips the towel off of her chest and onto around his neck. That's like, it's all part of the game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There is, I think there's always going to be a difference between sexy and sultry, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Rene Russo's aim to this is to be sexy, right? Pierce Brosnan's aim for this is to be smooth. And I always feel a little bit sexist saying this, right? Because there's like that aesthetic element to women in these types of films, especially in the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
But wow, did she knock it out of the park. In
the
sense where, like, she... We never doubted for a second that she was both smart and beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Which is something, like, most people don't believe in real life. So, yeah, but then, like, getting to see, like, how the movie moves and ebbs and flows. And once again, she's an insurance investigator. She's also morally great. She doesn't kidnap a child, so I'm okay with this film.
Yeah, this movie shuffles around those moral quandaries.
Yeah.
Because right from the start, this is not a bank robbery. It's an art heist.
Yeah.
So it's a very different feeling.
But then you have Dennis Leary's character,
yes,
who kind of plays that everyman detective, right?
Yeah.
Because he even makes the points of, like, oh, this is ridiculous. This painting costs how much money? You know, like he doesn't see the value in it. And he's supposed to play the everyman, but it's also supposed to make you kind of feel better about the moral gray.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, and that's kind of an interesting thing here is that, like, this is where it is fundamentally, like, a different tone in terms of even the set pieces, right? Like, this time out, Thomas actually is actively involved in the crime. We see him kind of be really cool and slick about it, unlike the last time where he was away from the action. Actually, the interesting thing about bringing in these hired guys this time is that it's a little bit more This is actually straight up like a group of furry, very aggressive characters this time. Even though they tried doing a similar thing, it doesn't really work out for them the same way. Mm-hmm. And the plan is actually almost dirty intentionally. You know? Yeah,
it's once you get to the part where Thomas Graham begins acting, you see that they were meant to fail.
Yes.
They were like a distraction almost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It wasn't, this was not a slick move on their end. Like, no, the point is get them away. Get mm-hmm. them to distract everyone else away. Mm-hmm. It's actually, again, this is where McTiernan shines. This stuff is slick. It's really well shot. Mm-hmm. It's very, very cool.
And it has a lot of attention to detail.
Yes.
Right? So one of my last positions, I actually worked in fraud. And, you know, like, I had to learn a lot of fraud-based detection just to, you know, like, keep sharp and everything. Mm-hmm. But one of the things I really appreciate is, you know, after the actual art heist itself, they actually go back and watch the tapes. Mm-hmm. And Rene Russo is the one who points out, how many legs does that bench have?
Yeah.
And that small sort of attention to detail, that's something that most people would miss. But it already shows in that one interaction, it shows her brilliance. It shows, I guess, I think it shows like the elegance of the heist itself.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think that's why I am so drawn to heist movies in the first place, because it's the mix of we shouldn't be doing this, but we're doing it as smooth as possible.
Yeah.
Like, and I'm, you know, some of my favorite heist films, right? Like Ocean's 11, Baby Driver. Inception.
Yeah.
Right? Like, these are things that, like, played around with the tropes, but this one did a really good job both updating and like, adding its own ideas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, there was also the, like, heat detection cameras.
Oh, yeah.
That apparently John McTiernan drew from real life when he was working on Predator.
Oh.
They had some problems with that, and he was like, hey, what if I put that in the movie? And he did. I thought that was kind of a neat touch.
Yeah.
The whole thing. But that team, I like this opening scene, because that team that fails... Mm-hmm. There's a moment where you think that they're going to, you know, face off against the older docent type security guard who seems like kind of gentle but firm.
Yeah.
And it almost seems like, oh, they're going to beat this guy up or shoot him. And he beats the crap out of them.
He has a cattle prod.
That was so bad.
Like, dude, you are a museum docent and you carry a cattle. This is the...
Yeah.
Dopest museum I've ever seen.
Pretty
in my
great.
Life.
It's so it is the Met.
Yeah.
Right? But the funny thing is the Met wouldn't let them film inside.
Of course.
So the outside is the Met. Okay. They were like, yeah, you can film our outside, that's fine. The inside is the New York Library, dressed up to Yeah.
It's pretty good.
That is so cool.
Yeah. Dang, it's a slick library.
It's the smoothest library.
Yeah.
Also, I love how once he busts out of the catapult, he's like, excuse me, Mr. Crown. And he's just like...
Well, like, I have never loved anything that much in my life, right? Yeah, this dude good. Loves art so much, he gets to carry a cattle prod, and he actually rose to the occasion. When there were four dudes probably armed and a helicopter with C4, the dude was like, well, I got a cattle prod, let's freaking do this.
Yeah. That's pretty good. But yeah, this is how Thomas, he gets in. He has a second briefcase that will hold the bars of the wall or whatever. Mm-hmm. He rolls in, takes the painting. The interesting thing here is that if you notice, the painting's bigger than his suitcase that he puts it in.
Yep.
Yeah, so then like it folds out and then he has to fold it back in.
Yeah, so there actually was a detail that they originally had where you saw that he did have to kind of break the edges of the painting to fold it to get it in the briefcase. Mm-hmm. They realized audiences didn't like that. So they just kind of cut that out and let you kind of forget that it shouldn't fit in there.
That legitimately bothered me.
Yeah.
Because I was
thinking, because it's like, how did it fold?
Yeah.
It would have to break.
Yeah.
And they had filmed that and audiences didn't like it. So they made it so that somehow it fit. We see that it folds, but somehow it's not broken.
It's kind of... That is interesting, because I'm starting to go, like, what was the audience that went, like, no?
I don't know.
They just showed it to, like, a bunch of, like, art museums.
I would. They just start weeping.
Right? Just wailing in the audience.
So one guy's like, what would you do?
You just hear, like, oh, my God!
It's just that cry where you can't breathe.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a movie. It's fine.
It's not a real painting, I swear.
So, you know, we get some touches and pieces, right?
Yeah.
Like, in the original Thomas Crown, like, there was a beautiful model type, who was also a model for the time itself as well. Mm-hmm. But then here, who is that model?
Oh.
I looked her up, and she's, like, not in movies anymore.
Yeah,
like,
yeah. So then we have her as well.
Yeah.
And so, like, it's kind of implied that, like, she's, like, hooking up with Thomas Crown.
Yep.
And not age-appropriate, yeah, right? Mm-hmm. And so we have that piece. We have the cat and mouse game, but this one I felt more comfortable with the cat, yeah, and mouse game here, right?
Well, she has Renny Russo has a very strong introduction. She kind of, like, you know, steps into the scene as, like, you know, look at me. Like, I'm going to get some shit done. The second time when she comes in to help with the investigation, she has, like, a weird green drink, mm-hmm, that someone asks, like, what is that? And she's like, you don't want to know. It's like, what is that? Why is she like this? I don't know.
When I think back on my like, lessons I learned in film school, one of the things that I always have to kind of... That was a great lesson to kind of learn, and I always thought, like, okay, something I always keep in mind whenever I watch movies or even come up with stuff is give your character a really good introduction.
Mm-hmm.
Like, see if you can find as many ways as the audience can figure out who they are as soon as they show up. Specifically in movies like this, where it's like a heightened reality. So, yeah, Faye Dunaway, yeah, she makes an entrance. Rene Russo makes an entrance. And yeah, like I said, like, there's that drink. That weird pre-kale smoothie acai bowl world drink. And yeah, immediately it's like, what are you... Why are you drinking that?
Yeah, she was ahead of her time.
Yeah, she was. Yeah. Before we forget, I don't bring up Dennis Leary as Detective Michael McCain this time out. Mm-hmm. And here's the thing, like, Leary... was kind of coming to his own as an actor around this time. You know, I think the first couple movies that came out with him, and it's like, just be Dennis Leary. Mm-hmm. Just be as Dennis Leary as possible. I always remember Demolition Man, where they just said, okay, now Dennis, just do your ranty, angry thing for 3 minutes.
Oh, God.
You know?
Oh, I didn't even realize that. Because you meet him after the Taco Bell scene.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. So it's like, just be Dennis Leary. Just be Dennis Leary for a couple minutes. Here, he's trying to come to his own as an actor. I legitimately really like him in this movie.
Oh, yeah, me too. Yeah. It was just, it was like I said before, it was that everyman scenario, right?
Mm-hmm.
There is a ridiculousness to this film, and he constantly points it out. But also, like, he grounds it in reality, too, yeah, right? He's a cop. He has to follow the rules. And this lady is obviously breaking the rules of what he needs to follow.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, we get that in the other one, but it's blatant, right?
Right.
She kidnapped a child. It's blatant.
In this one, she steals his keys,
yeah,
and then make a,
yeah,
copy, and she has to get him back before he notices.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, it's a heist within a heist film.
Well, yeah, and then he obviously noticed, because he switches it out. Like, he's yeah, very good at this.
I mean, keys dropping in a pocket, that's... There's certain sleight of hand things in heist films that, with me being trained to look for that stuff, like, it really bothers me, mm-hmm, right? First off, that pocket for a lot of suits, that's not a real pocket.
Yeah.
And even when it is a real pocket, it's usually sewn shut, and dudes aren't supposed to put things in it, mm-hmm, right? So then the fact that he had it open was like, okay, that's kind of weird. And the fact that he was keeping his keys in it, I'm like, okay, that's even weirder, right?
Yeah.
So now it's like my love of suits combining with, like, all my work professions. And then when you drop keys, there's a weight to, mm-hmm, it, right? And, mm-hmm, so even when you pickpocket... Like, you, and this is, I think this is, like, revealing too much, but when you pickpocket, you're supposed to only use 2 fingers, or, mm-hmm, or less if you can. The joke is, you know, whenever you pickpocket, if you can use less than 2 fingers, you're really good. but yeah, so you're supposed to be using it like tweezers.
Yeah.
Right? So tweezers are supposed to, like, that's not a blunt instrument, right? Like, you're just, like, it's as lightly doing it as possible and all that, but there's weight. That stuff, and that's what you have to take into account.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It just super bothers me. Sorry. Also, hacking goes. I know nothing about computers. Hacking always bothers me in films.
Just type a lot and fast, yeah, and you're good to go.
Well,
you hacked it.
And we didn't talk about that in the last film. But Steve McQueen had all these, like, high tech computers for 1968.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't even think they developed this stuff in 1960.
But here it is, I guess.
Yeah. Well, he's rich. It's, they're assuming.
That's true.
But yeah, so she manages to get the keys so that they can, you know, kind of get some look around. But then when they actually get the... It was funny. The warrant scene is funny.
Yeah.
Because that's before the keys.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. But I really... The warrant scene is really funny because his lawyer's right there. Yeah. That was really funny. That was Ben Gazzara, who was in Big Lebowski.
That's right.
That's how I always think of him.
And, like, the big difference for this one, right, is, like, Thomas Crown is always a step ahead.
Right.
I only really feel like the last Thomas Crown was a step ahead at the very end of the film.
Yeah.
Right. You find out the reveal, right? With this Thomas Crown, he's always a step ahead.
I almost feel like that's because of the heightened nature of heist films now.
Right.
Yeah. Like you said, the heist within a heist. Heist films now, if they don't have like seven heists and two of them are double crossing four of them, it's like we're like, oh, we're bored. Yeah. We've seen this before.
Well, and also because this movie's obviously intentionally like essentially a slightly different tone than the first one. Mm-hmm. This isn't really a left, you know, back-to-back action set piece film, you know, but it does feel like it has to up the energy in a different way compared to a 1968 movie.
It's very much also like a white fantasy film.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. It's just like, oh,
that's a nice house. Whenever I see those kinds of movies, I'm like, yeah, I would like this movie because that's a nice house.
But the way that I saw it was like, okay, the dude is already rich, right?
Yeah.
Which is already the American dream.
Right.
So then the dude is so rich, he wants to do bad things, which is another thing. And then there's a white woman who is just as smart as you, but then also is chasing after you.
Right.
Right. It's that want, right?
Yeah.
I just, like, you know how we talk about, like, white savior films a lot, mm-hmm. or, like, white savior narratives? This was, like, a white fantasy narrative
for me. Sure.
Yeah.
Oh, sure.
Like, everything was very, very upper class.
Which, that's actually a little fascinating because, okay, so we didn't talk about this up top.
Mm-hmm.
There is word.
Yes.
That there's going to be another remake of this movie.
Really?
Yes.
Starring Michael B. Jordan.
Oh, my God.
Produced by the Russo brothers.
So that would be super different from what you're describing.
Well, here's the thing. I was trying to figure out where I could bring that up.
Yeah.
Because part of the thing, and we'll get to the rest of this film in a minute, but I guess start stewing on these thoughts, and maybe we'll jump back to this question later. What? This is actually, I want to bring up, Andrew, this has never happened to us before.
Sure.
We always have done the current remake, and there was even a brief period we considered maybe pausing this and picking something else for JPG. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, no, we'll go through it. And I realize, like, this is a rare opportunity for us to go, like, well, what can you do different this time?
Yeah.
You don't have to answer it now. Stew on that a little bit while we're talking.
Well, I
would like to, that's something we've never asked.
I think I do want to say, because of the two, I think the art heist is the better narrative than just straight money.
Yeah.
But I think, again, it needs to differentiate itself in some way.
Well, the thing I like about the art heist thing is that it does, in fact, change even the motivation to a certain degree. It does change and fundamentally change the film completely compared to the other one. It's still a crime, but this crime has meaning in a different way.
Yeah.
You know, the other one was just, like, steal money. Even though he doesn't need money, that's the point. Here, it represents something else. And
So, like, it's breaking the law for the sake of breaking the law.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
As opposed to the larger narrative for the newer film,
mm-hmm.
right? There's like a cultural point being made here, you know, because they're constantly pointing throughout the film that things only have value because you give it value.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. As opposed to money, like, you have to give money value, right?
Right.
So once again, a blunt object... and elegance on this one. Mm-hmm. Pierce Brosnan is always going to be elegant.
Yeah, yeah.
I still feel bad for him about Mrs. Doubtfire.
Wow.
Sorry, I think about it a lot.
It was a drive-by fruiting.
Yeah. He would have given those three kids the super cushy life that probably would have had all their college paid for. Sally Field would have been super happy because even at the end, she's alone.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I love it.
Wow.
So many tangents, I'm sorry.
But okay, and
Believe it or not, not as many as some other hosts. Other guests, so you're fine.
to tie it all back in again.
Mm-hmm.
Michael B. Jordan. Oh, we've seen him before.
We have.
He was in the Fahrenheit 451 remake
with
that Alex was on. It all
It's all in the web that we weave. It's all here.
It's all connected. Hashtag it's all connected.
And then Russo Brothers, Winter Soldier.
Yeah.
Yes. Oh my.
It goes deeper.
I hate myself.
But no, I want to touch back on that, see if there's anything we can come up with. Sure. Because, again, this is rare. We've never done that before.
Well, because I also think it's at a point where I'm not sure if that remake is going to happen.
They actually announced it at Comic-Con.
Did they?
Yeah.
Wow.
Russo's had a panel, and they showed a bunch of logos of projects they're working on. Thomas Crown Affair was one of them.
Wow. Yeah. Because I don't know about that 21 Bridges that's coming out, huh?
22 Bridges?
22 Bridges.
Hey, don't forget that one bridge.
That's how they make their escape. I don't know. And that's, I feel like that movie's really being sold that the Russo brothers are producing it or
we'll see. I mean, yeah. It's like, it looks, that's a whole other topic for a different show, I guess.
Anyway. So back to Thomas Crown.
Yeah.
Do we want to talk about the, I actually really enjoy when, the way that they update, instead of having him play polo, he's on like yacht fighting. What are they doing? They're like on dangerous yachts. What is that? It's like two sailboats, but one man is like on the far end and like they're swinging at each other.
Don't look up the name. We're just going to refer to it as yacht fighting.
Yeah, yacht fighting. It's fine.
Yeah.
I think I saw this in Long Beach somewhere in the docks.
Ultimate yacht fighting.
But that's what it looks like.
Yeah. Again, white people.
instead of polo, which is thought of, you know, it's very much like the trope of like the rich white guy. They want to do just something a little more dangerous, a little more exciting,
but so much flashier.
Yeah. So, you know, he ends up crashing the boat, and then from that, Rene Russo kind of gleans like the whole idea that like he doesn't care, like he's kind of reckless. I don't know. I think that's interesting.
And I think, they make the distinction that he hasn't found anything that he's cared for yet.
Yes.
Yeah. And I would say that this cat and mouse would made me feel a lot better. Mm-hmm. In the last film, that felt a lot more predatory. This was a lot more that everybody was on equal footing.
Definitely the case. Yeah, for sure.
But they go, they have a some kind of a date that extends into like a long weekend. Mm-hmm. Right,
he's glider
like,
scene.
Yeah, he's like, oh, why don't you the glider, the same glider from the original? We didn't even talk about that.
That's something I'm like, before that film, like I knew nothing about. So like, they basically just take you up in a plane and then you just fall.
Yeah, like, you fall with style.
Yeah,
as Buzz Lightyear would say.
It's interesting they decided to abuse that element again. Mm-hmm. But I guess it is kind of a really cool.
But instead of in the original, we didn't even talk about the other girl Steve McQueen version.
She only shows up twice.
Yeah. But she's meant to be kind of like to make, you know, the Faye Dunaway character jealous. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But also like maybe he would run off with her instead. It's just to show that he's just playing the field.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which again, like there is a character in this film that does in fact
that is meant to imply that.
And the twist for who she actually is, I absolutely love.
It comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
It's a really good, I mean, we're jumping ahead a bit. I don't care. That's fine. Mm-hmm. But that is a really good setup to that.
Yeah.
It is really, I was going like, wait, what was that?
Yeah.
Oh, that's oh shoot. I didn't see that coming. That's pretty good. Yes, but there is a character that is implied, and I think it's even clear, like, this character actress is clearly some model at the time. But what else do you want to talk about?
They go on this plane date, and then it goes into, like, a long weekend, and they go to Martinique or whatever. Mm-hmm. And that's all, like, a lot of, like, fun little stuff. That sequence where he has in a crate a painting.
Yeah.
And he says to her, do you want to see it? And that's all he says. And she just goes, no, because, you know, we are meant to think that it is the painting that he stole.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. And so he asks several times, they're drinking, they're having fun. And eventually she walks over. She goes, you would never have the painting here. Picks up the crate, puts it on the bonfire, walks away. It's just like, oh my God. Like the power play that's happening there is off the charts.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah.
It's a real painting, though. It's not the painting that he stole. It's one that he bought, and it's priceless.
The scenes, that little bit of acting between them is really good, mm-hmm. because it's a scene where basically they're both like, who's going to break what just happened. It was like, who's going to mentally break? And there's a little moment where like Rene Russo's character is like,
yeah, it's caught on fire. It's burning.
She's starting to see an actual painting under there. Yeah. And I'm like, so what was actually in there? It's like, oh, is that? This was like, and you can see she's like, oh, fuck, oh, fuck.
Dying.
Yeah, yeah.
She does kind of like, when she does let it out, she kind of gets up and stomps and like goes, yeah, like, oh, whatever.
But even before that, like, there's a little bit of Thomas going, So, you know, hey, the 85 wasn't very good, so we should probably try it another one. She's like, yeah, yeah, 85 wasn't very good either. There was like, they're both not trying to break the moment and try to save face, but they're also both like, fuck, that is really burning.
Well, and then this comes after we didn't even talk about the dogs playing poker. So when she does finally get into his place and finds his little secret cubbyhole, there's the painting. She has a very triumphant walk into the police station. They bring in an expert, right? Yeah. The way they bring in the expert, I'm like, ooh, this is gonna... I love the way that this turns on her, right? Mm-hmm. Like, the way that it's like... He's like, hello, I am a painting expert. And I'm like, oh, this is gonna turn on her real good. And so he's like, oh, there's something underneath. And she's like, well, of course. What, was it a Rembrandt? Who's the Monet?
Well,
Monet.
No. So
it was
like,
Monet,
so,
right?
So yeah, a lot of painters actually would reuse canvas.
Yeah, and that's what she said. She's like, mm-hmm. Monet reused a lot of canvases. Mm-hmm. And then they look under the whatever special device allows them to see under paint.
Yeah.
And it's dogs playing cards. Like, it's not dogs playing poker, but it is like that same scene.
It's that same sort of scene.
So it's that's really funny. Like, that's just really funny.
The film does, in fact, also do that scene again, the one I brought up earlier for the, which is like the always catch a man scene. And it's funny because I guess I always wanted to bring that up because when I saw the trailer for this one back in the day, that's the centerpiece trailer. That's the centerpiece of the trailer. It's almost as if they also knew, like, if you saw the original, it's like, it's a hard reminder that, like, yes, that Thomas Crown affair, where we are literally doing that, those dialogues, like, word for word, and delivered pretty much, but it's still delivered in its own way, because Pierce and Renee are very different actors, but it is, that's kind of where a remake can be fun sometimes. It's like seeing a play, but with different actors, when you do it in sometimes in this capacity, and that's kind of cool to see two very different actors play essentially a similar scene, but saying the same dialogue, but a slightly different tone, which is kind of neat. Mm-hmm.
So then we have, he does, Thomas Crown donates a painting to replace the stolen one.
Right.
Which he stole.
Yeah. It's very, again, kind of like, you know, turning in on itself. The idea that the original Thomas Crown influenced several Batman movies.
Yeah.
I feel like this sequence of, like, you know, Thomas Crown is covering up his own crime is like the way that Bruce Wayne takes care of, like, things that Batman breaks. Yeah. So he does that. Then we have the whole sequence, the Martinique, the whole thing. We can just jump right to the end.
We could.
The reveal of the other woman.
Yeah.
Because we have a sequence where she thinks she's being played. Rene Russo thinks she's being played.
Yeah.
She barges into the house and she goes up and they're like packing a suitcase together or something. Mm-hmm. Is that other woman.
Right.
And she kind of leaves wordlessly. And then they start to fight and he's like, you wouldn't understand. Mm-hmm. So then in the finale, when we find out who that girl is, she is like under his care.
Yeah. She's the daughter of she's the daughter of a, what was the term they used for this? A fake.
He's a forger.
A forger. Sure. She's the daughter of a forger for painters, which in turn, she's also taken up the, I'm assuming, right? She's taken up the family business.
Yeah. So she's taken up the family business and that's why the guy in jail was like, you know, Rene Russo talks about that wasn't him being impressed, that was pride.
Right.
Right?
That's my daughter doing a good job.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's a really good reveal because it's like, it plays with what you've expected that relationship. It makes, like, again, but it's funny, yeah, we brought up, and this is the importance of casting Rene Russo because of the age thing. It's an age-appropriate relationship, but of course she sees Thomas with someone half his age. And going, of course, clearly.
Yeah.
And you, the audience, go, of course, clearly. And if you've seen the original film, you're already writing in your head, he's going to bolt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
that's something that might happen in this because you saw the original as well. It's like, oh, he's going to leave. Mm-hmm. He's going to be a dick and he's going
to
leave.
But the way that he sets it up to her is he says, I'm going to walk in there and I'm going to replace the painting. Mm-hmm. I'm going to put it right back up on the wall. And I'm telling you when I'm doing it. And I'm saying that you can meet me afterwards and we can go on a nice little trip together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he has to trust her to not tell the cops. Well, of course she tells the cops.
Because she's hurt and she's broken and she's fallen in love.
Mm-hmm.
But then what follows is a really fun sequence.
Cut to Sinnerman.
Hmm?
The song Sinnerman.
Oh, yeah.
Which I love, the use of that song in the scene, actually.
Where he walks in, he puts on a bowler hat, and he starts wandering around. But then there's also other men dressed exactly like him, also wearing bowler hats.
My very little detail about the bowler hat bit is I'm not a genius art knower, so I looked it up on Wikipedia. But it's a painting I'm very familiar with, though. The fact that like the bowler hat is in fact referencing The Son of Man by René Magritte. There's a shot literally where Rene Russo's character turns and looks at the painting and went, I'll be damned.
Yeah. Well, and then when they catch one of them, they open his suitcase and it's copies of that picture.
Yeah.
On paper in his suitcase.
Yes.
Okay, so...
Like, Thomas Crown is, like, toying with them now. Yeah, this is above and beyond. No,
he really toys with them because we find out at the end of this, right, that, like... The painting has been under the other painting that he donated the entire time.
It's like this weird sprinkler system, which I had read that art museums do not use sprinkler systems because that would hurt the art.
Yeah, they use flame retardant systems.
Yeah. So that's completely made up, but it's still a fun reveal.
But then the doors only get stuck because there are two Crown and Associates pencils in there. But I'm like, no, dude, if you're just going to make a clean getaway, don't implicate yourself anymore.
Yeah, I'm sure a judge will find him guilty based on the pencil.
Just saying, man.
I can see Dennis Lear being like, the pencil! And the judge is like, you get out of here.
That's a flex. It's not lying.
The ultimate, if I've ever seen it.
The ultimate reveal is then when the kind of like painting shields go down, another painting is missing.
Yes.
One that's just as valuable.
And it was actually Rene Russo's character's favorite.
Yeah. As well as Thomas's. Because that's something that he was looking at early in the film.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really...
See, and I love that. There's like a sense of magic in that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Because how the heck did he take that? Well, we never know.
Mm-hmm.
You know? We found out everything else, but we'll never know how he took the other painting.
Yeah. So, but she kind of... She wants to return the painting.
Yeah.
She does get given to... She goes to where she's supposed to meet Thomas. There's another man in a bowler hat. Gives her the painting. She wants to return it.
Yeah.
She does.
She does, at the
airport. Yeah.
And then she gets on the plane, and she's just, like, mad.
Mm-hmm.
And then, who's there?
Yeah. So she actually starts crying. Yeah. She starts breaking down in the plane.
Right.
And it's kind of... Is it implied that she's going back home to Ohio?
Maybe.
I don't know. Anyway.
It's not really clear.
Yeah, but then, like, somebody hands her a handkerchief.
And well, like, the fakest of fake accents.
Yeah, it was a really bad Scottish accent.
It's like Brosnan going, like, I'm going to go real bad UK on this.
And then Rene Russo jumps over the chair.
Which, by the way, that's some Sky Marshall stuff right there. Like, if that happened now, somebody would have got shot.
The way that the stewardess reacts is like, hey, keep it down. And then she sees the kissing and she's like, oh, shucks.
Yeah, right. The flight attendant was super cool with everything.
Yeah.
Oh, they're in love.
Yeah. And then she says, Rene Russo says to Pierce Brosnan, if you do that again, I'll break both your arms. But here they end up together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's, you know, because modern audiences, we want the
honestly,
happy ending.
I like it. It's cuter.
But it does make me, you know, wonder how McTiernan would have done a sequel.
Yeah.
I haven't seen what people say that it is kind of loosely based on. But I can only imagine, you know, Rene Russo wouldn't be there. I feel like that would be, the magic would be gone.
Yeah. No, like, you can't just do a movie with just Thomas Crown, especially after this film. Mm-hmm. Going back to my question earlier, like, is, if there, the fact that we now know there will be another one, they're working on a new one with now Michael B. Jordan in the role. Is there anything that you guys, now that we've seen two in a row, is there anything you guys can think of, even just one, where you would go, you know what, let's change that?
I want to care about more characters.
Besides just the two?
Yeah.
Sure.
I think the 68 had it right with the way that they were using the cop. Mm-hmm. I think having the even if it's a fake love triangle,
yeah,
where the insurance character is kind of torn between the cop and the thief.
Yeah.
So you want a love triangle.
Yes, a little stronger. I think that's the only way you could build out the characters.
I want a heist team.
I don't think a team would work unless it was a team of rich guys. unless it's like Thomas Crown finds the rest of the Thomas Crown group.
Maybe not a team, but like a crew. Thomas Crown is a code name, not a name.
Oh, that's interesting. Now we're getting into it.
I will say that whatever it ends up being, like, the thing that I appreciated between the original and this one, and what this one does, is that it isn't just another bank heist. So for whatever they do with Michael B. Jordan, please don't make it another, you know, like, paint heist.
I want it to be sexier.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, like, okay. What's another white-collar crime that we can make sexier? It's just an hour and a half of tax evasion.
Right? Wow. I can't make tax evasion sexy.
I'm sure the Russo brothers can.
Yeah, it's possible. It's possible. It's possible. I definitely, because, like, that's the thing I liked about this one, is that it challenged... They decided to not go the easy route. Go, it's another... He organizes another bank robbery. It's like, no. They found a new thing for him to do with a new context and new meaning that it felt like... It felt refreshing in comparison to the original film. So whatever they do with Michael B. Jordan, I implore them to think hard and make sure it's something equally interesting and different from the other two films.
Well, yeah, if it's just paintings again, then it's nothing new.
You can find us online at BenviewNetwork.com/nothingnew and on Twitter at NothingNewPod. You can also contribute to our Patreon at Patreon.com/nothingnew.
This podcast is a part of the Benview Network.
You can find this and other podcasts like it at BenviewNetwork.com.
Did you see that moving truck?
What?
There's like some new people in moving down the street.
Oh, that's weird.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about them?
No, I mean, from what I've heard, they're creepy.
A little kooky.
Yeah, they're altogether spooky.